New Diplomatist Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Garrison Morado, and it is a high honor to be joined today by a special guest, Mr. Richard Fontaine from the Center for New American Security. Mr. Fontaine, thank you so much for joining our podcast today. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Now, sir, for those who aren't quite as familiar with your career, or perhaps first getting involved in the foreign policy podcast sphere, would you mind introducing a little bit about yourself, your background, your expertise, your work at CNAS for the listeners?
Sure. Well, I'm at a think tank in Washington, the Center for New American Security, where I've been for over a decade now and several incarnations. Currently the CEO of the organization. We do research and develop policy suggestions and recommendations and solutions across a wide range of national security and foreign policy issues. So I've been doing that here for about 11 or 12 years, I guess. And again, in different incarnations. And before that, worked in the government. I was the foreign policy advisor, Senator John McCain, both in the Senate and during a ill-fated 2008 presidential campaign. And also worked in the executive branch at the National Security Council and at the State Department, and worked for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So I bounced around for almost a decade around government as well.
Well, it's a wealth of knowledge, and it's an honor to host you on the podcast, and I know the listeners will appreciate all of that experience being brought to our subject today, which perhaps unsurprisingly is the current Ukrainian standoff and crisis between Russia and Kiev. Now, for those who have been following this, it has been in the news fairly consistently over the last several months in particular. Perhaps just a little bit of a basic background to get things started for those just getting their hands around the subject of why Putin is deploying over 100,000 troops, not only on the border of Ukraine, but also for military exercises in Belarus. Could you walk the listeners through what has led us to this point in time, particularly since the annexation of Crimea in 2014? Why do you think Putin is escalating tensions at this particular moment?
Well, the big reason is because he doesn't like the way things are and believes that this massing of troops on Ukrainian borders might lead to a change in the way things are, in a direction that would be in the interest as he defines them. There's kind of two levels at which this is operating. I mean, the big picture is, you know, the European security order, the expansion of NATO to the east, the locking in of former Warsaw Pact countries and countries that are got increasingly close to Russian borders. Putin doesn't like that. He said this is a security threat. He said this very consistently. And it's also said, essentially, that the West did this at a time when Russia was weak, and Russia said that they didn't like this, and that it was a security threat, and the West didn't listen to them, and now they're not weak anymore, and so the Russians will be heard. You will hear our concerns. You will act on our concerns. You won't ignore our concerns anymore. You won't take advantage of us anymore. And that's kind of the big picture. More specifically with Ukraine, after Crimea, the Russians stirred up this separatist war in the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine, which, you know, killed possibly up to 12,000 people, a really nasty, bloody thing that happened there. And the fighting was stopped with two separate agreements that both contained under the broad title of the Minsk Protocol. So the Minsk Protocol was going to guarantee great autonomy for the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine and distance from Kiev. What Putin and what the Russians have seen over the past couple of years, but especially over the past year or so, is really not much movement on the implementation of the Minsk Protocol. The Ukrainians, now that the fighting is not raging as it was before, quite understandably, don't want to rewrite their constitution to give one of their areas the kind of autonomy that they had to stomach at the barrel of a gun. The President Zelensky of Ukraine came into office talking about a rapprochement with Moscow, and then again, quite understandably, immediately started to pursue closer ties with the West once he got in. And there's been, you know, increasingly an alignment of Ukraine with the West, NATO joint exercises, the presence of U.S. military advisors on the ground, the military assistance to Ukraine, things like that. These are the kinds of things that Putin fears and that he wishes to not see happen. And I think what he is trying to do now is see if he can change that reality of the Western alignment with Ukraine through the threat of or actual use of military force.
Now, this particular issue of NATO expansion is something I'd like to drill down to a little bit at the start of our conversation, because it is a matter that's consistently raised by the Russians as a sticking point in their own thinking and was included in their list of demands, so to speak, that was sent to Washington as well as to NATO, that Ukraine be barred from joining the NATO alliance. Now, if we go back to the 1990s, even as early as 1994, the Clinton administration was internally discussing memos that were declassified in 2018, the possibility of NATO membership for Ukraine, as well as the Baltic states, that should be held open as a possibility, and quote, we should not consign them to a gray zone or a Russian sphere of influence, end quote. Now, that is more or less where we still are today. Ukraine is not a member of NATO, and they're not fully a vassal state of the Russian sphere of influence. They're sort of caught in this twilight zone between the two sections of interest. And one more thing to note as well, at the time from the Clinton administration, they said to make clear that the expansion of NATO was not to be seen as directed against any country, including Russia. And they even left open the possibility that a democratic Russia, again, this is 1994, if a democratic Russia were to materialize, that they might even be considered for membership. This is a rather large question, but how did we get from 1994, when there were open questions about NATO not being directed any particular, you know, against any particular country, Russia potentially becoming a democratic member at some point in the future, to almost a Cold War grade standoff happening along the eastern flank of NATO?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think a lot of it has to do with how both Russia and the NATO countries, or at least the United States, perceive the same things very differently. So the idea in the 90s was, we're going to expand NATO, we're going to pursue a NATO, or Europe that's whole, free, and at peace. NATO expansion, unlike during the Cold War, wasn't a threat to Russia. I mean, NATO countries have no desire to invade Russia, to try to topple the Russian government, to, you know, do anything like that. And so why a Russian leader would see NATO expansion as anything other than good would be hard to understand from the Russian perspective. You know, it sort of fits a historical pattern of the invasions to Moscow have come through the West. They don't have a lot of geographic protection. They have liked large buffer zones on their borders filled with compliant governments that are preferably aligned with them and by no means aligned with an adversary. So what the United States and others saw as a pretty unmitigated good, the Russians saw as a pretty unmitigated bad. Now, that's a broad stroke. Not all Americans thought that. Not all Russians thought that. But generally speaking, that's kind of how it was. And the Russians weren't in any position to do much other than complain here and there, and they did a little bit of that. But they also did things like join, you know, the Budapest Memorandum and other things like that, where they, you know, signed on to the principle that countries have the right to choose their own alliances and things like that. So, you know, you sort of fast forward to where we are now, and something that Vladimir Putin has long thought is a threat. He believes and has believed over the past few years that his country finally has a chance and the power to do something about it, whereas before in the 90s it didn't. But the 90s, Russia was just being taken advantage of. Well, they're not going to be taken advantage of anymore. Something's got to change. Now, that's a far cry from something actually changing, I would point out. I mean, the things they put on the table in terms of rewriting the European Security Order, rolling NATO back to its pre-1997 posture and things like that are never going to happen. But it's indicative of the way that Putin and the Russian leadership see the world and the way they see NATO, which is not, you know, a club of benign democracies that they might join one day, but rather, you know, an alliance of actual or potential adversaries that has gotten close to their own country.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, the Russians have demanded, as part of their list of requests from the West, if you can call it that, that Ukraine be barred from ever joining NATO in the future. Now, Biden, the Biden administration, has explicitly denied this as a possibility and said it's Kiev's right to choose whether or not they will join that alliance. However, it is notable Ukraine has never joined NATO up until this point, even though they've been an independent country for several decades now. Do you think it is possible, if this current crisis abates, that they will ever become a member of NATO? And if not, does that mean that this is something of a moot point between the two capitals?
Well, forever is a long time, so you can't rule it out, but not in the, you know, next few years. Both because, I mean, even if the United States tomorrow wanted to bring Ukraine into NATO, then the Europeans, the Western Europeans, would object because of the provocative nature they think that that would have on Moscow. But also the Ukrainians themselves haven't met the kind of criteria that's necessary in terms of a stable democracy with the right kind of military for NATO. So Ukrainian membership is not, you know, in the offing anytime soon in NATO, but it's the prospect of that. And even short of NATO membership, the sort of general Western orientation, increasingly Western orientation of Ukraine that seems to threaten the Russian leadership. So, you know, there's a open question about whether there's some trade space here. I mean, if it's the case that one of the reasons why Putin might take military action in Ukraine is because he thinks it'll be a member of NATO, and yet no time in the foreseeable future will it actually become a member of NATO, then maybe there's some sort of a recognition of that reality that stops well short of saying that it will never be a member of NATO, or Russia gets to veto the membership of NATO or something like that. But that is just entirely unclear whether there is any such trade space.
Makes sense. Now, in terms of present NATO posturing, we've obviously seen the Biden administration commit to not sending U.S. troops to Ukrainian soil. However, they have recently deployed troops to Poland and the Polish-Ukrainian border as part of a reassure the Allies commitment. We've seen lethal aid donated by the United States, lethal aid donated by the United Kingdom, secondhand arms sales from the Baltic states down to Ukraine. And then there's been one particular hiccup, if you will, in this relatively coherent NATO response, which has been Germany. Now, of course, the new German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has been reluctant to join this full-throated NATO defense of the eastern flank, and there's a lot of theories as to why that is. But seeing as how he is on a diplomatic visit to Washington, D.C., meeting with the Biden administration even as we speak today, what's your opinion of the German Chancellor's calculus and what that implies for the current strategic situation for NATO from the German perspective?
Yeah, the fact that Olaf Scholz is in Washington, I think, is a recognition that there's the perception of some division between Germany and the United States, and frankly, between Germany and the rest of NATO at this point, on these big questions of what to do with Russia and Ukraine. I mean, the Chancellor's got a political problem and an economic problem. His economic problem is German dependence on natural gas from Russia to keep energy supplies going in Germany. They phased out nuclear power after the Fukushima disaster in Japan a few years ago. They've been building the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is this $11 million pipeline that would bring natural gas from Germany to Russia. Germany is dependent on buying gas from Russia, and they worry that if they take too coercive or too hostile a posture toward Russia, then they could put their energy supplies in jeopardy. That's the economic side. On the political side, it's a new government. Angela Merkel is there for a long time. Scholz has come in. He's, for the first time ever, got a governing coalition of three parties that have not always been in the same place, particularly on Russia policy. The Greens have tended to be quite hawkish on Russia. The Social Democrats have tended to be the opposite. And he has to try to herd those cats into a consolidated position that he can support. Now, that, I think, helps explain where the Germans are coming from. But events are quickly overtaking those problems, where, you know, it is becoming painfully obvious that Germany is the laggard in combining the countries of NATO or the transatlantic partners together behind a consolidated position with respect to Russia, sanctions, Nord Stream 2, et cetera. And so I conjecture, it's only that, but I conjecture that you'll see greater sort of bullishness out of the Germans going forward, despite the fact that the Chancellor's got these economic and political challenges.
Now, if we shift the view from Berlin towards Paris, the French President Emmanuel Macron visiting Moscow, coincidentally today as well, in an effort of what some might call last-ditch diplomacy, or he would call continuing dialogue. Now, apart from the specifics, which are not fully reported yet, it is interesting to note Macron, throughout his tenure as President of France, has continued to articulate this vision that's, I mean, it's not entirely a new development in French strategic thinking. They've said it before, all the way back to Charles de Gaulle. But this relatively new iteration of Europe as a strategic balancing power, operating in between Russia and the U.S. or the U.S. and China, still committed to NATO, but sort of exercising some distance, particularly on the economic sphere, to protect Europe's interests from what they feel like is sort of a periodically maverick American government under presidents such as Trump, who have demanded more out of the Western partnership. Do you feel that this strategic approach of Europe together but apart from the U.S. as a strategic force or balancer, do you think that has any realistic prospect of becoming a geopolitical reality, or do you feel this is simply an attempt to try and articulate some new path in diplomacy?
It's hard to see what that would really look like in practice. I mean, I think the view of Macron is that a strategically autonomous Europe that has some distance from the United States and no longer includes Britain because of Brexit would de facto be a French-led Europe, mm-hmm. which probably sounds good to the French.
Yes. Yes, probably.
But is greeted with a degree of skepticism by the Germans and you know, some of the other bigger countries in Europe. And of course, if you're talking about strategic autonomy, presumably it's strategic autonomy from the United States, but it opens a can of questions about precisely what positions you're going to take that are different than the United States with respect to Russia or China or who knows what else. So it's conceivable that the French continue to try to carve out this more quasi-independent role. Whether that turns into a European leadership role, I'm a lot more skeptical because I just don't know how many countries are going to go along with that. And certainly as you get further to the east in Europe, those countries tend to trust the security guarantees provided by the United States more than they do those provided by Western Europe. And so there is less of an appetite for anything that would sound like strategic autonomy. You know, there's also a dose of domestic politics in all of this because, you know, there's a presidential election coming up in France, you know, the opportunity to go to Moscow and potentially come back with something that other world leaders have not been able to extract or elicit or announce is a nice opportunity for someone who is trying to emphasize the importance that France plays in the world and one's own international leadership. You know, we saw a little bit of this from a different perspective when Boris Johnson in the UK just went to Ukraine for meetings, and it may have had something to do with the fact that Partygate, which, you know, the scandal over the parties during and number 10 Downing during the pandemic was the brewing story at home, and there was a potential opportunity abroad, at least for a day or so.
Yes, absolutely.
But, you know, if we fast forward a few years, it's hard to see how truly autonomous Europe would be. I think there's some areas where that might be true, technology policy, for example, or some things on the economic side. But militarily, in terms of an alliance, I think NATO's still there, and I think it still is largely fulfilling the same function that it is today.
Interesting. Now, for the last few questions, sir, because I do want to be respectful of your time, if we zoom back in on more of a tactical level to the actual Ukrainian crisis, as I said earlier, the Biden administration ruling out any U.S. troops being deployed to Ukrainian soil. Certainly, the Russians now have well in excess of 100,000 personnel on the Ukrainian frontier. There's debate in different circles that I've seen about how long the Ukrainians could hold out were an invasion to commence, particularly given the ambiguity of how far Putin might want to push the invasion, whether a partial or a total takeover. But it was General Miley who even this last week stated, well, an invasion would probably topple Kiev inside of 72 hours. So most of the focus from the U.S. press has been on sanctions and a sanctions reply involving perhaps SWIFT payment system and other, you know, pretty significant economic retaliation on the part of the Western alliance. If that were to occur, if Putin were, say, in the next several weeks to engage Ukraine, to invade Ukraine, and we enact SWIFT sanctions, surely there's retaliations that the Russians would put into place with gas and so on. What do you see, just as I know this is very hypothetical, but kind of a war game, what does the week after this invasion's commencement look like in terms of this economic battle? And do the Western nations really have the leverage to inflict enough pain to overturn such an action?
Well, there's a difference between overturning such an action and preventing it in the first place. And I think, you know, if Putin invades eastern part of Ukraine and occupies the Donbas, and the West imposes all these sanctions, the chances that he then a week later or something says, oh, actually, we're getting out, please relax the sanctions, is very, very small. You know, over a long period of time, maybe things are different. I think it's too early to tell, in part because the kind of sanctions that are envisioned, I don't know that SWIFT is still going to end up on the table, but, you know, the push to sanction Russian banks and try to derail Russians intertwining with the international financial system. No economy the size of Russia's has been subject to those kind of sanctions before. So there's some unknowns both in how this would work and what the potential spillover effects would be, but also what kind of reactions Moscow might have to that. You know, so therefore there's a big question mark about what the week after looks like, in part because of the unprecedented nature of this, and in part because we don't know what the week before is going to look like.
Of course, yeah.
Between doing nothing and toppling the government in Kiev and occupying the country through a full-scale invasion, there's a lot of potential scenarios that are available to the Russians if they wish to choose from them. So all of that is to say that one can't say with any certainty what kind of response there would be to the imposition of sanctions. But there are some potential vulnerabilities, certainly, that in imposing very coercive sanctions, the United States and its European partners need to be aware of. I mean, Russia has considerable cyber capabilities, as we discovered in the 2016 election, and, you know, the Colonial Pipeline shut down over ransomware attack and some other cyber attacks. It's possible that Russia retaliates against the imposition of sanctions with cyber attacks in Europe or in the United States or both. There is this issue, obviously, of the provision of Russian gas and oil to Ukraine, to Europe, rather. Europe gets about 20% of its oil and 40% of its gas from Russia. And oil and gas sanctions, at least in my understanding, are not on the table because of that dependence. But then that puts Russia in the position of being able to interrupt those supplies as a punitive measure. And there's some work being done about if that were to happen, where would additional supplies come from? You know, could they come from the Gulf? And what might that do to the oil and gas markets, et cetera? But those are the kinds of things that would be available, kind of instruments that would be available to Moscow in terms of response if they decided to respond to coercive sanctions with some degree of coercion themselves. But it's hard to say, and it's hard to say also because it's hard to envision what the end game of that would be. I mean, Russia could, you know, launch cyber attacks, but is it going to do that indefinitely? It could embargo all or some degree of sales of oil and gas to Europe. Is it going to do that indefinitely? That's where we, you know, if we get down that path, I think it really is terra incognita.
Very interesting. Now, again, on the understanding or the thought pattern, if Putin does decide to invade Ukraine, either partial or total, certainly if total, there's been a discussion amongst various U.S. policymakers who have been pushing for what, you know, some in the Obama administration called the pivot to Asia, what others under the Trump administration would call this focusing on, to borrow the title of Elbridge Colby's book, Strategy of Denial. Anyway, a focus where the U.S. says our number one peer competitor or rival or whichever term you prefer is going to be Beijing. It's supposed to be our focus on China. We must focus our limited resources on pursuing some sort of effort to ensure that we don't become held hostage from a Chinese hegemon, at least regionally, over the world's most important economic area. If Putin follows through with this invasion, again, potentially all the way up to full-scale decapitation of the Ukrainian government, what happens to the U.S. pivot to Asia, and how does the United States balance this sudden and renewed security threat in Eastern Europe with a continued and more long-term structural competition with China?
Well, it makes it harder. And if you spin this out and imagine what some of the effects are, if we say, for the sake of this discussion, that we don't know exactly what Russia would do in Ukraine militarily, but it does something to trigger the kind of threats that have already been put on the table, what are the consequences thereof? Some of the consequences on the military side are that the United States reinforces NATO's east, so it moves troops and materiel to NATO's east, close to the Russian borders. You know, already we're sending a few thousand troops at the reassurance message, but one could imagine that increasing. Well, it would depend on where those troops are coming from. If they're moving east from bases in Germany or something, that's one thing. But if it's troops or materiel or weapon systems that otherwise would be deployed in the Indo-Pacific, well, that has an effect on your pivot to Asia. Similarly, on the sanctions side, if the Russian economic relationship with Europe, and even if its oil and gas sales go down because of this, one can imagine the Russian dependence on the Chinese market actually increasing rather than decreasing. And what we've seen over the past few years is increasing intimacy between the Russian and Chinese governments. And that is, you know, a challenge to the pivot. And there's also some specific things. I mean, if the United States and its partners were successful in throwing the Russians out of the international financial system and not allowing them to use dollars to transact payments and things like that, might they denominate payments in renminbi, which is something that the United States would not want to see happen because we wish to preserve the special privilege that goes along with dollar-denominated payments and not to see China emerge as, you know, its currency be the means of exchange in that respect. So the bottom line is it would make it harder. But here's the thing. It's also not right to say, well, then let's do nothing or threaten nothing because the real game is in Asia, because these things are interconnected. And we're trying to read the tea leaves of what Putin thinks, but we also have to read the tea leaves of what Xi Jinping and his leadership thinks. And if the predicate is set that a country like Russia could say it doesn't like an unjust, as they would say, settlement of the way things are in their near region and can use by force can change the borders to its liking despite the condemnation and warnings by the whole world not to do it, and there aren't consequences, important, you know, serious consequences for that, well, what kind of lesson does that send to the way the world is likely to react to any Chinese revisionism, you know, whether it's respect to Taiwan or Indian territory or, you know, the South China Sea? I mean, if the lesson is, well, we just don't really care that much, then I think in some ways this is, it's not quite a test case, but it's illustrative of whether the United States can actually do what it is threatened when it has threatened these things. So in that sense, you can't just say, well, the real game is in Asia. We want to pivot to Asia. We want to focus on China. So let's, you know, let the Russians do what they will with Ukraine so we can focus on the bigger picture. The United States, at the end of the day, remains a global power with interests in multiple regions of the world. Countries will watch American and its partners' actions in multiple regions, try to discern lessons for what they could do or not do in their part of the world. And so there's no kind of easy answer to all of this.
And my last question of the day for you, sir. When you survey the Biden administration's response thus far to this Ukrainian crisis, what letter grade, if you could, would you give them and why? And we'll kind of end there.
Well, I mean, I guess this is like a easy answer, but it's incomplete because we don't know whether this is all going to work or not. I would generally give them a pretty high grade on the response thus far, because I think that the deterrence side of things, both militarily and in terms of sanctions, has been pretty substantial. I don't think that the deterrence side is enough to prevent the Russians from moving into Ukraine, if that's what they are inclined to do. And therefore, I think the diplomacy is really important with the Russians to see if there's some trade space where reasonable Russian concerns can be accommodated, you know, on things like the transparency of exercises on both sides of the border or something like that. You know, it's hard to keep the Ukrainians feeling like the United States is on their side, but not going to fight their war for them, to be able to deal diplomatically with the Russians, to line up the NATO allies behind all of the other measures one would like to take. That's a multifaceted foreign policy exercise, and I think they've done pretty well so far. I think if there's a critique, it's that it's felt largely reactive, where the Russians have the real ability to escalate or not, that most of what is announced and done is a reaction to what the Russians do or don't do, or now even to what some of the Europeans are doing or not doing. So, you know, I would prefer a little bit less reaction and more trying to announce, you know, new initiatives to deal with this in a way that would be proactive.
In your mind, what would be a proactive sort of example as an initiative that might be able to shift the momentum back towards the, you know, the DC side of things rather than the Moscow side?
Well, I mean, I think part of this the administration has started to do on trying to work out a deal with the Gulf Arab oil and gas suppliers to provide energy to Europe if Russia were to cut off things. I mean, doing that proactively, I think, starts to make other things possible. You know, another idea, actually, Bob Zelik was speaking about an idea kind of along the lines of what I'm about to suggest. But, you know, if you had a couple of countries, France, the United States, Canada, announce, you know, a package of economic support for Ukraine, that would send, I think, a message of those three countries acting together to support Ukraine in a way that it is not completely supported today. So you can imagine a few of those kinds of things. And if you started to add those up, it might create possibilities that don't currently exist. That said, I don't know whether that would work to prevent a war in Ukraine. And the administration's grade will turn in part on whether what it has done prevents a war in Ukraine. But the only guy who knows whether this is all going to lead to war or its absence is Vladimir Putin, and he's not telling, yes, as far as I can see.
No.
So, you know, not even his own diplomats seem to have much clarity into what the plan is, and they are trying to maintain maximum flexibility. And so, you know, you see these statements out of his diplomats, everything from, you know, it's ludicrous to suggest that we would ever invade Ukraine. We'd never do that. And, you know, of course, if our demands aren't met, then, who knows, you know, non-diplomatic means might be necessary.
Yes, well, indeed.
Not sure exactly how those things are consistent, but they're not supposed to be. They're just maintaining flexibility. So that's a long way of saying the administration could come out of this with a quite high grade or not. And to some degree, it's out of their hands.
Well, definitely something that we will all be watching and keeping an eye on the weeks and potentially months ahead. But Mr. Fontaine, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today and sharing with your expertise and of your background on this subject, which is important. And we appreciate your time. Do hope to have you on again sometime in the future. Maybe we can make a more reflective episode talking about how that grade panned out after events took their course. But nonetheless, thank you again very much for coming on the New Diplomatist podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.